ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
What do Rasputin, Tupac, and Pharaoh Ramses III have in common? No, it's not the weirdest boy band ever. They all met their end at the hand of an assassin. From seizing power to silencing dissidents, Assassins unpacks the moments in which someone decides that murder is the move. Search for Assassins with Aslan Pahari on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you could travel into space, would you? Even if the answer is yes, of course, you're unlikely to get the opportunity unless you're an astronaut or a billionaire or perhaps a pop star these days. So for us mere mortals, or those who actually prefer to stay on the solid ground of this one here precious Earth, space is really a place that's left to our imaginations. And today on Big Ideas, two absolutely extraordinary writers who have had no trouble imagining space in all its incarnations, including the author of the 2024 Booker Prize-winning novel, Orbital.
Another thing Sam and I discussed this morning is that if we were sent to space, we would feel a lot and then we would quickly die. Because we would be hopeless at all the other kinds of forms of repression that you need to be good at to, you know, survive in a very hostile environment.
We decided we would produce one spectacular poem and then that was it.
Dead.
Hello, I'm Natasha Mitchell and welcome to Big Ideas. This is your front row seat to the best live events here on ABC Radio National and the ABC Listen app. And we have a fabulous event for you in this show. For all of human history, space has been this place of wonder and awe and intrigue. And that's a feeling that the Booker Prize-winning British author Samantha Harvey captures just so exquisitely in her fifth novel, Orbital, which she describes as a space pastoral. The author and science writer Keridan Dovey's really stunning short story collection, Only the Astronauts, gives the objects floating in space a voice, personalities, a perspective. Today they join award-winning novelist and essayist and former editor of the Griffith Review, Ashley Hay, on stage at the 2025 Sydney Writers Festival on Gadigal Country.
We are going to talk about some pretty spectacular stories and some pretty particular, not landscapes, but spacescapes, I think, today. It's an amazing thing to think that these two writers were working on their books at the same time. This is, I think, the dream pairing of writers and books for a writer's festival. So thank you both for letting your imaginations work as they did, you know, across recent years. This is brilliant. I think what is most wonderful about this conversation is the confluence and the complementarities between Requiem in Only the Astronauts and the time that we spend on the International Space Station in Orbital. So I just can't wait to get into that. I want to start, Samantha, with you. You described Orbital as a space pastoral, and I wanted to ask you how you came to be in that space in the first place and what that definition gave you to work with when you were inventing Orbital.
Yeah, okay, so well, firstly, thank you so much for being here. This is an amazing audience, isn't it? It's incredible. And I get to sit in this golden chair.
We did suggest there should be a Booker crown and things.
And it's really comfy as well, isn't it, this seat? It's unusual. Yeah, so I think I invented this idea of space pastoral, really because it sort of articulated something about my project with Orbital, which was not to write sci-fi and it was not to write something speculative. It was not to write something that was catastrophic or that was projecting human fears of onto this kind of arena of space. It was about looking at space as a natural environment and as a lived environment and looking at it sort of using the space station as a setting for that and thinking about the view of the Earth from the space station as with a sort of a kind of yearning and a reverence and a nostalgia, almost as you do with, as pastoral writing tends to do, sort of this very reverent treatment of the natural world, but this sadness at something that's passing. You know, it's an innocence lost, or a kind of, you know, the pastoral novel is sort of about the kind of nostalgia for the innocence of pre-industrial landscapes. So it's sort of, I was trying to get to that a little bit, the idea of looking back at the earth with this yearning and this sort of feeling of being amazed and connected, but of also losing something, and that kind of extended into the space station itself. And I think in Only the Astronauts you talk about this so beautifully, with this kind of idea of the ISS being deorbited and an era ending with that too, sort of an era of peaceful cooperation in space, and of, you know, it was in some sense a peace project, the ISS, and its time is coming to an end, and we're entering a new era and a new paradigm. So the whole book is really about that kind of looking back, in a way, an era that's passing, where something that is really the most magnificent piece of technology mankind has ever created, the ISS, as a sort of vintage thing now. It's kind of a bit retro, and you know, the sort of sci-fi space future is moving into the past, and I find that really interesting.
Thank you, and thank you, Carolyn, also for being here. And I want to make it clear that Only the Astronauts moves well beyond the ISS. We're going to talk about that, but also your thinking and writing about and in space ranges beyond fiction as well to some wonderful non-fiction in inner worlds, outer spaces. And I love your description of space objects as special and enchanted. Can you explain that particular enchantment and its genesis for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think space objects, it's like you can fall under a spell with them, and once you've fallen under that spell, it's very hard to get out from under it. And certainly for me, it's been about 10 years now. I first fell under their spell when I interviewed the space archaeologist Alice Gorman, who many of you would know. And I was just interviewing her for a profile. It was just meant to be like a once-off, you know, profile for a magazine commission. But she told this story about being in a room of scientists when the European Space Agency's Rosetta orbiter was intentionally crashed into the asteroid that it had been following for 2 years, and how every scientist in the room was just sobbing, like was catatonic with grief. And something about that really, I found very, very interesting, because as an anthropologist, I used to study material culture, and that idea of an enchanted object or a vibrant object is something that comes from Jane Bennett, and she writes about these objects that work on us just as we work on them. So it's actually that they set up a relationship between you and the object that is mutual. So the relationship is actually requited. And I think there's something about space objects in every context in which I've now encountered them. So thanks to Alice, all I want to do is think about space objects and space. And I kind of come at it from all these different ways. So through nonfiction and science writing and weird experimental films and weird stories. And one of the things that I've found is that in these rooms where you have the serious space scientists, you know, like the astronomers and the astrophysicists and the people driving the things that are on Mars, and the only time I have often seen them express any emotion is when they talk about their relationship with a space object that they have launched and that they continue to be in a relationship with. And the language they use of that is often the language of family and kin. The lead scientist on the Mars Spirit rover mission actually referred to it as his child. And he would get angry at it when it disobeyed him. And he'd get really, really proud and tearful when it did the right thing. And when it actually went, it got stuck in sand. And you might remember there was a whole global kind of thing to free Spirit from the sand, and they couldn't free it. So it died. And, you know, again, these kind of, you know, grown-ass men just like sobbing over the rover. And so I think for me, that is really what I'm interested in, is what do these objects that we launch into space, both the ones that stay out there and, you know, do become disobedient to us, but also the ones that come back and are often then, you know, kind of turned into relics that we collect in our museums. And if you've ever hung out in a space memorabilia collection, like the ones that have flown, the ones that have gone to space and come back are treated as if they are kind of holy, even if it's just a tube of cabbage soup that a cosmonaut didn't eat, you know. The fact that it went up and it came back makes it really magical. So for me, because I'm interested in humans, I'm interested in what we value and how we make meaning. It's that interaction and that the way they are working back on us for space objects that I just think I'll never quite get to the bottom of.
Mm. I wanted to ask both of you, and Caradwyn, I'll ask you first of all, we're talking here about the sort of this lovely sort of emotional response and relational response to these objects. One of the things that struck me reading both books was there's an enormous amount you can research about the International Space Station. You know, so much of it is there. You can look on your phone and see where it is right now. But then there's a lot that you can't find out about it, you know, a lot of sort of how things work or what you do. And I wanted to ask you, Caradwyn, first of all, just to talk a little bit about the relationship between the research you could do on the ISS, how they work, the kind of ebb and flow of the day, you know, what people are doing. And I know you were in touch with some of the astronauts who've been on the station. But then through the voice that you imagined for the structure, the kind of observations and facts that you could gift to it that were, you know, were your creations, were your sort of ideas for its voice in that way.
Yeah, this was something actually Sam and I were speaking about earlier, and I'm really interested to see what you have to say about this. But while I was writing these stories, I was also making these films that were about emotion and ethics in space. And one of the films is also called Requiem, just like the story in the book that's from the perspective of the International Space Station. And what I thought would be interesting was to write a kind of speculative poem, a sonnet cycle that imagines the last astronauts on board the ISS farewelling it before they leave it to be deorbited. And when it's deorbited, no one really knows, but maybe 2030, 2032, chunks of it will be aimed towards a spacecraft cemetery in the very remote Pacific Ocean. So I wrote this poem and then thought, oh, wouldn't it be interesting to have actual astronauts, you know, voice this poem? And so began to reach out to astronauts. And many of them were incredibly generous with their time and weirdly agreed to voice these sonnets that were putting words in the mouths of people who've actually been to space, but also forcing them to feel things. So all of the sonnet speaking astronauts are feeling a lot, like they're really feeling grief and they're expressing it in this form. But in the interactions with the astronauts, it was often hard to really get much emotion out of them about their own feelings. And Sam and I were just talking about this, and you know, it is a kind of different sort of role. I think government astronauts are more like bureaucrats or sort of military personnel, and that, you know, there's a sort of sense of restraint. And so for me, it was kind of all the things that I couldn't find a way to find out or to hear about in the reality of the space station. I was like, I just would tuck it away and think there's got to be another form in which I can explore that. And so that's where the beauty of fiction is, the element of the imagination and the poetic license that you can use, and that I really used, you know, with great joy in this story, because you would take a tiny little anecdote and then you would just run with it and turn it into, you know, whatever you wanted it to be. And I think that's something that I loved about, you know, your book, that I could sense that there was this beautiful mix of the where the research just takes flight into, you know, the imagination, which is actually the vehicle which we've done our most interesting spacefaring through, you know, as a species, is what we already have in our heads. So the physical thing becomes less important.
Yeah, exactly. I agree with all of that. And I felt when I was reading Caradwyn's book, and particularly the ISS section, because there was so much there that I could relate to,
I just thought, God, this is like meeting myself. This is like meeting my own mind. You know, this, we're on the same page. You know, we think thinking the same thoughts. And it was a really extraordinary experience. And also you're thinking thoughts that I didn't think. But as soon as you articulated them, I was like, of course, yes, that makes perfect sense. And there was some, I think Only the Astronauts is a completely remarkable book. It's not like anything else I've read. And this idea of giving voice to the object, to, you know, man-made objects in space, and this enchantment, the, you know, that something that's brushed with space does kind of gather around it a sort of force field or a mythology, doesn't it? And you just, you know, put that into story form so brilliantly. And I think that's really what I was trying to do as well, but in a sort of different way. In fact, I was thinking when I was reading your book of that, it's not really related, but it just made me think of the Ted Hughes poem, Full Moon and Little Frida. Do you know it? I don't know if anyone here knows it. It's this really beautiful short poem about Ted Hughes being with his daughter, Frida, and it's a dusk in a sort of rural evening, and there are cows, and he's describing the landscape, and then his daughter points suddenly at the moon and sort of says, you know, moon, moon. And the last two lines of the poem are something like, the moon steps back like an artist gazing amazed at a work that points at him amazed. It's just such an amazing poem. It made me think of what you were doing in your work, this idea of because the moon is not a man-made object, probably. I'm sure there are some conspiracy theorists who think it is, but you know, this idea that we look at objects and they look at us back and we're in a relationship with them. So I think that's all really so present in your book and so brilliant. And this idea of, you know, I have also talked to astronauts, not while I was researching the book, but since it's been published. And I was speaking to the British astronaut, Tim Peake, who said, you know, he was entirely fed up with people asking him what space is like. He's like, why can't somebody ask a different question? So one time somebody asked me how deep the regolith was on the moon. He hasn't been to the moon, but he was like, you know, someone had asked a lunar astronaut how deep the regolith is on the moon and what it felt like to stand in it. And he said, that's the kind of question we want to be asked. We don't want to be asked what space is like. But I was thinking, yeah, but most people are not that interested in how deep the regolith is on the moon. Most people are interested in this question of what something is like. And that seems to me what fiction is so uniquely brilliant at expanding on. It's a big thought experiment in what something is like. What is it like to? So that's very much what Orbital is trying to write into that gap of what it could. Of course, it's all imagined because I'm never going to space. But you know, what would it be like to be there? And so much of the research that had to be made up was that at that emotional level of what is the, or not just emotional, the experience level, what is it like to experience that, which is something is quite difficult to extract from astronauts. I think that they're just, why should they be able to articulate this? It's not their field, you know.
Forget the astronauts. They should send a poet or a novelist into space. Writer in residence, anyone? But then perhaps there's no need when we have writers like Samantha Harvey, author of the Booker Prize-winning space novel Orbital, who joins you today here on Big Ideas on ABC Radio National and the ABC Listen app from the stage of the Sydney Writers Festival. She's with the author of Only the Astronauts, Keridan Dovey, and the host is author and editor Ashley Hay. Now, if you've ever travelled between time zones and had a bad case of jet lag, yes, we've all been there, spare a thought for those astronauts on board the International Space Station.
I think there's something I want to come back to. I'm going to have to really keep an eye on the time because I could go for about 8 hours on this. So someone throw something at me if I do. But I want to come back to this idea of language because I think the things we don't have language for is really important. But just sticking with this sense of the thought experiment and the lovely gift of fiction offering us experiences we can't have. Something that I kept coming back to, particularly rereading the books alongside each other just recently, was questions of scale. So Orbital brings us into the rush of the ISS orbit. So for those of you who haven't read Orbital and don't know, the station goes around the Earth 16 times in every Earth day, which means that the people on the station see 16 sunrises and 16 sunsets in every 24-hour period. But this happens, and this was the bit I found mind-blowing, 250 miles above us, 400 kilometres. So that is incredibly close in terms of distance. That is, for Sydneysiders, if you could get in your car and drive to Coffs Harbour but up, you would get to the space station. Like, it's you can do it in a day, half a day. It's insane. So we've got this rush and this speed, and that's not even touching the sides of the vastness of the universe beyond that. And then this tiny little David Bowie tin can, keeping all these elements and measurements. I had the sense of, you know, the sort of the images of atoms where they've got the everything sort of spinning around in combination or suspension with all the space. It's just keeping the big and the small, by which I mean the absolutely most big and the absolutely most tiny. Can you talk a bit about the process of that balance, that sort of creating that structure in a way?
Yeah, I think that, so it's in the structure of the book itself, in that, you know, it's the book is set over one 24-hour period, so an Earth day, which is the kind of tight, the artificial time structure the astronauts are asked to abide by, even though they are travelling at 17,500 miles an hour and seeing 16 days every day. So I wanted to replicate artificial nature of that structure and put it in the book so that you've got, you know, this quite small time frame, and within it the kind of loosening of time and the upending and the unspooling of time as it must be experienced when you're there. So there's a baby, that's really cute. so that time frame can sort of hold the depth and the explosion of time as it's being experienced. And then, yeah, there are all these other points of scale that are, you know, being confined in this little, as you say, this little tin can, and then having the cosmos sort of so viewable and so close. You know, they're not looking at it through the Earth's atmosphere as we all are. It's sort of just there, present and three-dimensional, multi-dimensional. And the Earth itself, which is kind of close, as you say, it's really close. You can't see the whole of the Earth from the ISS, very far from it. You can see kind of a swathe, like a flank of it. And they're just always cresting over its horizon, and it's falling away, and they're falling with it. So you can kind of see a lot, but the Earth is the dominant view, and it's intimate and it's close, and you start to feel like the continents are all just back gardens. You know, they've become very familiar the more you look, and very known, and the whole experience is weirdly intimate, even though you would think it would be this anonymous, sort of alienating view, but it's sort of a way of seeing our home with a new closeness somehow.
I think there's, I'm just trying to look through now because I can't remember which one of you said this, Keridwen, I think. One of your astronauts thinks he should only think extraordinary things because he's in an extraordinary place. Going back to this sense that it was quite hard to wring emotional responses out of the astronauts, you couldn't really exist at that level, could you, and do the work that you have to do and do the, you know, make the thing keep running, teach the mice how to fly, whatever it is, if you were thinking in this more existential way the whole time, you must have to turn that off to be an astronaut in the first place. The extraordinary thoughts, you know, have to be sort of the accidental ones, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, another thing Sam and I discussed this morning is that if we were sent to space, we would feel a lot and then we would quickly die. Because we would be hopeless at all the other kinds of forms of repression that you need to be good at to, you know, survive in a very hostile environment.
We decided we would produce one spectacular poem and then that was it.
Dead. And I think one of the great ironies of space, and this goes for any extreme places on Earth, you know, Antarctica or the Arctic or the deep sea or wherever, is that I think it often attracts people who romanticize what that experience is, and that they think that in going to these wildernesses, they are going to be able to escape themselves and certainly escape other people and escape their bodies and only be thinking, you know, these transcendental thoughts. But the terrible irony is that in those places, you're thrown back more clearly than possibly in any other situation onto the fact of yourself being a human body and the body's needs and the body's tyranny over your thoughts. And so certainly for me, I think one of the things I was trying to look at in the space station stories, because it's narrated by the space station itself, which is a kind of living being that's, you know, being created out of these modules. It's almost got like a reptilian brain at the core, the early Zvezda Russian module, and then everything's kind of added on. I think one astronaut described it as a sort of spider in space. But it's aware of all the living that's gone on inside its walls, and it is the only witness to all the stuff that will never exist in any other official records of the kinds of embodied living that have happened in this place. And so that's where I really got interested, is like what happens to bodies in space and how they break down, and these details that I think we were both so drawn to around food and sustenance, but also toileting. And, you know, certainly at the museum where I do some work, the number one question that kids will ask is, where do astronauts go to the toilet? And there is a urinal in the collection from Soviet times and a shaving machine. And, you know, so I think being thrown back onto your body, but then also being thrown into these systems of mutual care with other humans, it's so not how I think, you know, the Elon Musks and the kinds of people who have the power to make things happen in space think about what is actually going to happen there, that there's going to be a mutuality of care and an extreme dependence on other people that perhaps doesn't exist. That ethic of care perhaps has not existed for them on Earth. And so it's both wonderful and terrible to be thrown back on your body in this way. And many of my characters in the space station story, they're really struggling, you know, they're struggling with peeing on themselves, and they're even just opening packets to eat. It's like you're made into like a child again, and you have to relearn everything in this, the new laws of microgravity. And there's so much frustration in that. It's not just, you know, glory and wonder, but yeah, that really interests me, that kind of like graininess of bodies in space.
And them having to, you know, all their food has to be kind of consumed through straws or with spoons, you know, like a baby. And you have that that astronaut, I wanted to ask you if this was true or not, the astronaut who is looking at the Earth and thinks that she should be feeling something very grandiose and profound, and all she can sort of feel is dismay because she can see how we're not all in this together. You know, the Earth is not an equal place. It's not like we're just one crew on one on spaceship Earth. You know, we're actually not in this together at all. Was that a true, that felt true?
Did no, you that was that me getting on my high horse and saying something I felt.
I'm and sure that someone has felt it.
I hope someone has. And I know, you know, I showed you the giant dog ears I made in your book, where you have one of your characters have a similar thought around the politics of want. It was such an interesting passage because, you know, we all know about the overview effect, and that's one of the things that the space station is meant to grant us. And, you know, yes, that's a beautiful idea, and there's so much goodness that can come from that perspective. But when you really break it down, that idea of like the actual engine of what's happening on Earth is what you describe as the politics of want. And so the astronaut goes through that thing of they kind of having these profound thoughts, and then they look a little bit more closely and they're like, actually, that's the engine of our species, is the politics of want. And the typhoon that is forecast throughout the book, you know, and then right at the end there's an image of the child and the mum kind of huddling, and you briefly go to their perspective. You actually return to Earth through their perspective. I found that really, it's in the last few pages of the book. But for me, that is the thing as well. It's like, how do we not just you know, go weak at the knees and think that anything that happens in space, because it's happening in space, is therefore good for humanity, which I think was maybe an appropriate way to think about it 20 years ago, and it's no longer appropriate now. In fact, it's dangerous now to use that as a cover for the other kinds of profit-making that are about to happen in space, as it's zoned from a scientific zone into an economic zone. And if we're not alert to that, then we're going to let it happen right in front of our eyes, as is happening. But also that, you know, sense of looking back at Earth and the awareness of the realities of life and how very different it is for everyone. So I just find myself thinking, I don't know if the overview effect is very helpful in terms of what do you bring back from that to actually enact into your own place in the world.
Yeah, that's right. I often think that the overview effect is a little bit overstated and maybe overhyped, because even astronauts who've lived on the ISS or been on some mission in space come back and don't all turn into climate activists, do they? I mean, kind of far from it. Some of them do, but most don't. You think if it were that powerful an effect, it would change the way they live on the Earth and the way that they spend the rest of their earthly time. But that doesn't seem to happen, and I wonder if we're just not a species that can think at that scale. You know, we can hold it in one sort of in-breath for a moment, but then it's gone. You know, we just get back into the, you know, into the detail of our lives and the desire to have things and to acquire things and to sort of comfort ourselves with stuff, you know.
And perhaps we can all think of a few people who could benefit from the overview effect right now, looking back at this precious planet. Natasha Mitchell here. Big Ideas is the show right here on ABC Radio National and the ABC Listen app, or wherever you love listening to a podcast. And I'm really thrilled to be bringing you this conversation with the Booker Prize-winning author Samantha Harvey, whose novel Orbital imagines life for astronauts on board the International Space Station, and Keridan Dovey, who's written the short story collection doing a similar kind of imagining. It's called Only the Astronauts, and they're joining us from the stage of the 2025 Sydney Writers Festival with host, writer and essayist Ashley Hay.
There are several moments in Orbital where you talk about the knowledge that the six astronauts have in dreams. Sometimes they're dreaming the same thing at the same time. You know, sometimes it's just they're just on the cusp of that kind of knowing or understanding something, and of course then they wake up and it slips away, and it feels a little bit like that. But I want to go slightly further away from the Earth and to an eminently extractable landscape, which is the moon. And I want to talk about moon dust for two reasons, Keridwen. One, you're the only person I know who has interviewed a moon dust specialist, which has to be the best job in the world. And I, in your short story, The Fallen Astronaut, which is also in Only the Astronauts, you do this fabulous thing, which is combine what you know about moon dust with the absolute chutzpah of voicing the ghost of Neil Armstrong. Now, speaking of enchanted objects, let's just kind of go in here. So there's a tiny little statue on the moon, which is a real thing. And in this book, this is where the ghost of Neil Armstrong has taken up residence. Can you talk to us about just tell us that story? It's a brilliant story. It's an absolutely brilliant story. And Neil Armstrong is one of these astronauts who, you know, he did a lot of things, but he didn't come home and change the world.
Yeah, there was a joke among Neil's compatriots that a long sentence for Neil was no. So I just thought, wouldn't it be great to have him stuck on the moon in this little statue and just get terrible verbal diarrhea, but like poetic, you know, and single-handedly invent a new language for the moon landscape that, you know, he didn't have the words for it when he was actually on the moon. But yeah, the moon dust thing relates to that, because when the first astronauts went up, you know, the reason that it wasn't Neil but it was Buzz who printed his boot print, you know, it's the most famous photograph of that mission with the ridges that you can sort of see And the reason they took that photo was because they actually thought that the moon was going to be have like sinking sand. So NASA was really worried that when they stepped onto the moon, they were just going to sink like stones. And so they took that to show that it had bearing power for the human body. And on that same mission, they had a set of science experiments that didn't last very long because they lost power. But on that same little set of experiments, they had a tiny thing called a dust detection experiment, which had been designed by an Australian physicist called Brian O'Brien. Best name ever. Brian died a few years ago. He was in his late 80s, but I was lucky enough to interview him about this extraordinary story of how he got this experiment on the moon, and it's still the only real data that we have about moon dust and how weird it is and how weirdly behaved it is. And he basically then lost the tapes, and they were only found 40 years later, and he went back through them and realized that they had this really valuable data on moon dust, which shows that it may actually get electrostatically charged in sunlight and from the solar wind and from the cosmic radiation that hits the moon because there's no atmosphere. And so it may actually levitate during the daytime and then fall at night, and that it's extremely fine and extremely sharp. So when the little micrometeoroids hit the surface, they briefly kind of turn the dust into liquid, and then it rehardens into these glass particles. And so when Buzz and Neil were trying to put the flag in the ground, they actually couldn't get it in for quite a long time, and they said it was almost a PR disaster because they couldn't get it in because of the tiny glass particles that are in moon dust. So I had done all that with Brian and, you know, gone down that, you know, rabbit hole with him. And what I kept feeling is like, what a pity that we didn't have poets set foot on the moon, you know? And, you know, Buzz had the magnificent desolation line, which is lovely. And, you know, Neil had his, you know, giant step quote, which is also lovely. But a lot of the other later Apollo astronauts were actually horrified by what they saw on the moon. And they describe it in very disturbing terms. It's like a lifeless dust bowl and like a dead place and a grey, like they almost a sense of horror and close bordering even on disgust that they felt for this place. And if you look at the Apollo missions up to Apollo 17, it's like they're coding it as dead. And I actually think that that language of the moon being a dead dust bowl that's just irradiated rocks is still playing out now in how we imagine what we might do on the moon. Because, you know, we only defend the things that we love. And if we're thinking of it as a dead landscape, well, not even as a landscape, but just a dead rock, and we're then coding it as our eighth satellite, which is the latest sort of rhetorical thing I've seen lately in the space industry, is they've started to describe it as our eighth continent, not in a way of like, oh, it's part of Earth, but to say we're going to go and do the same things there that we've done here. So they're kind of normalizing that narrative. And if you think it's dead, then you can go do whatever you want on it. So this story was really important to me because what I wanted to do was take the language of nature writing from some of my favorite writers. So Annie Dillard, who's the American Pilgrim at Tinker's Creek, if you haven't read it, please do. And then Nan Shepherd, who was a British writer who wrote about the Cairngorms in Scotland, these mountains that she lived amongst. And she spent her whole life just writing these very short texts that then were lost for many years and only rediscovered. So I actually took their language and put it into Neil Armstrong's mouth to try to find a new language for the moon and to shade the moon as a nature place of incredible value, and that hierarchy we have of life, proof of life, as being the only way to code value, you know, really moving away from that and beginning to actually, my dream is that we begin to think of the moon as a place like Antarctica or the Arctic, and we begin to put the same sorts of restrictions on what might happen there as we have often with Australian diplomatic and scientific leadership in the Antarctic. We begin to say, let's buy it some time before we go and do the same things that we've done here. You know, it deserves more than that, you know. There's much more interesting things that we can think of to do than to simply dig it up. Mm.
Do you think that it's inevitable that we are just going to go and dig it up? I mean, there are the Artemis Accords, aren't there, now, that sort of 50-odd countries have signed up to, that make some sort of pledges about how we treat the moon and Mars if we're to get there. But they were drafted by the Trump administration, and you can't really imagine that there isn't something kind of sinister underneath it all, that I can't quite trust that.
Yeah. I mean, I actually think the Artemis Accords were a way to get away from their responsibilities under the existing space law. So there's 5 space treaties, UN space treaties, that have been in existence from the late 50s that are quite extraordinary in their language. So that idea of, you know, astronauts being the envoys of humankind and space being only for peaceful purposes and all kinds of, really came out the same time as the Law of the Sea. So that connection in both of our books between, you know, these two global common resources or commons, that same legal language and framework actually applies to space and to the sea. And unfortunately, I do see the Artemis Accords as an American attempt to reinterpret black letter space law to say, we will go and use it. And they've actually got the right as American citizens to not only mine space resources, but to own them and to sell them for profit, which is very controversial in space law circles, because actually, you know, there should be no sovereign claims made in space. So I think it's a kind of cynical way of trying, again, using the, oh, let's go to the moon, this is going to be amazing, there'll be so much science done. But I think actually underneath that is another whole agenda.
I'm going to sneak one last question in before I pick up the iPad, and I'm going to go out from the particular of the moon to even bigger things than orbital. One of the things I loved reading, Sam, was when you talked about some of the commonalities or the conversations that you feel run through all of your novels. And to be clear, that means, you know, spanning an unexpected death in 1491, a man who's literally losing his memories and his life to Alzheimer's, and a very explosive return to a lost friendship. And you say that you feel faith and time are the common thread that runs through all of these. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about how they fed Orbital, whether it was unexpected to find them there or whether you could see ways that they would come into play from whatever the genesis for the book was.
Yeah, I realised that I always am really interested in time in my books, in both the way the novel can play with time and the way you can depict time in novels. And I think I've done that with all of my novels, Orbital definitely. The 1491 novel, The Western Wind, which is told in reverse chronology and tries to say something about the protagonist's wish that he could reverse something that's happened that he wished had not happened. And then the Wilderness, which is about someone getting dementia and trying to use the narrative structure of that book to simulate maybe what the experience of dementia might be like from the sufferer's point of view. So this has always preoccupied me, and I think it always will. And then the question of faith, I always write about religious faith in my books. And when I came to write Orbital, I thought, I'm definitely not going to write about faith. I'm just going to avoid it. And I sort of do. I mean, there is one passage in there that's directly about the two different astronauts' experience one of the astronauts has sort of the creationist Christian view and the other is atheist or at least agnostic. So I do kind of talk about it a little bit, but I was really, really resolved with this book not to go there too much. And I think that's partly because I wanted to write a book that was about the experience of wonder, of being amazed, of awe, and all these things that we associate with space and the experience of space. So I thought that that's the kind of primary experience, and whatever our worldview is from there, whether it becomes a religious one or not, is sort of born in that moment of understanding that something is bigger than us or beyond us or inexplicable to us somehow. And what we do with that is for each individual to decide, but that's the bedrock, that's the primary experience, and that's what I wanted to write about with the book. So I really tried to avoid directly confronting ideas of faith as such, except, I suppose, questions of our faithfulness to particular experiences and to sort of embracing experience and going deeply into it, as I sort of tried to allow my astronauts to do, whether they really do or not is another matter. So that was, it's kind of an attempt in orbital with faith to sort of not have to address that question in some sense. I don't know whether it succeeded, because a lot of people say to me they feel it is about faith or about some kind of or spirituality or something. But I think it's interesting that people take different things from it.
I think there was one lovely line where I think Nell and Sean are talking. Sean is the creationist astronaut. Nell is the English astronaut. And they're having the conversation of, how can you think this? And Sean says, well, it's about seeing a heedful creation, a creation. The universe is something that has been made with care. And Nell says, well, it's just something that's happened randomly. It's heedless. And you write, is it just about the difference in the amount of heed? Which I thought was one of the most beautiful phrases, that this enormous question might come down to something so simple. Was beautiful.
But I guess the impulse, the feeling when, so that, they're talking about looking out at the kind of the spacescape and the galaxies and the nebula, like the experience of looking at those is one of sort of in expansiveness and of somewhat a lack of knowledge, a lack of understanding. We have, it remains mysterious to us by and large. We understand a lot, but there's so much we don't understand. And of course, the more we learn, the more we learn how much we don't know. And so that experience of the mysteriousness of it, the strangeness of it, the precariousness of our being here on this rock for a very limited amount of time, that's the same experience for both of the astronauts. They've just extrapolated from it in different ways, and whether it's heedful or heedless, if you sort of feel that it's all just been thrown there by the Big Bang and there's no design to it, which is surely true, then that doesn't detract from the sort of mind-boggling mystery of it all. In fact, for some that advances that mystery, because it's not explained away. So I sort of wanted to keep coming back to the primacy of that experience of confronting something that is so much bigger than us and beyond our understanding.
I'm going to sneak one Slido question in, or I'll never be asked back. I'm going down the list a little bit in case you can all see the list, which you may be able to, just because I think we've touched on some of these already. But the one, actually, it's gone up the list now. This is a quick one for both of you as well. If you could have one experience in space, this is from Jack, walking through the red dust of Mars, watching the aurora on Saturn, what would you choose? Sam?
Oh, gosh, that's hard, isn't it? Maybe you know.
I don't want to go to space.
Yeah.
I don't think any humans should go to space. I really believe in staying with the trouble I think we've got to focus on this planet. So thank you for the question, but actually it is a... It is an... I mean that not just facetiously, but... there's no reason for us to go to space. And years ago, I interviewed the climate change activist, Bill McKibben, and he was like, I just think it is a criminal endeavour that we spend any money whatsoever in going to space. And, the reality of it is they'll tell you that there's all these great things that have come to us from space, like Wi-Fi and medical advances and things. The truth of the matter is that it is a military space more than anything else. It's just that we know very little about that part of it because it's all classified. Pretty much every launch, everything that goes up, every object that goes up, it's a dual military commercial launch. So the commercial things piggyback on a defense launch. Defense is a huge customer and client for all of these new space industries. So, yeah, I think it's really, really important actually that we are very careful about even assuming that it's a human right to go to space or that it's part of our destiny, because then we're going back into really dodgy kind of thinking around, you know, the sorts of expansions that, you know, we've experienced on this planet and claimed as a human thing, you know, that it's human to explore, it's human to, you know, head out beyond your horizon. But I think that's actually, if we're going to, we send all these new technologies into space, but I think we actually need new thinking and new ethics to be able to keep up with them. And that's where I would like to see the time and energy spent. Mm.
Okay, I've got a red flashing light at me now. Sam, is there anything you'd love to do in space or no? Can I just say, I've got this image. So in Orbital, there's this moment where Nell goes for a spacewalk and you describe it and you say her right foot is obscuring France, her left foot is obscuring Germany, and if she reaches out her hand, she can touch Western China. I would like to put you in space just so I could see you doing that, because I thought that was the most amazing way of understanding a human against the world. But, you know, I'm offering that up for you if it's useful.
I mean, I would never, ever, ever do a space... I would never go to space like Caradwen. I far too cowardly, but I would never do a spacewalk. That would be just... It made me feel quite nauseous just writing that section.
Earthbound, yeah. Earthbound. Yeah. Huge thanks to the Sydney Writers' Festival again for bringing together these two amazing writers and offering me the chance to talk with them for a while.
Thank you.
And if I can ask you all just to give one more round of applause for Samantha Harvey and Caradwen Davey. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ash.
Thank you.
What a gorgeous conversation, using space to reflect on our place in the universe and on this extraordinary object that we call home, planet Earth, with Samantha Harvey, author of the 2024 Booker Prize-winning novel Orbital, and Caradwen Davey, writer of fiction, non-fiction and science, author of many books, including Only the Astronauts. The host was Ashley Hay, who is author of several acclaimed titles, including the narrative non-fiction book Gum, The Story of Eucalypts and Their Champions, and the novel The Railway Man's Wife. And that conversation was recorded live at the 2025 Sydney Writers' Festival. Big thanks to its team. And you can find more conversations from this year's festival via the Sydney Writers' Festival podcast. Now, next week on Big Ideas, you may know her from the courtroom or in the press, representing plaintiffs in really some of Australia's most high-profile defamation battles. Why does Sydney barrister Sue Chrysanthou want to cancel culture?
I described cancel culture as not merely immature, but also infantile. I've said that it eschews rationality in favour of the mentality of the mob, using modern technology to do so. And I'm going to argue and hope to convince you tonight that it is fundamentally corrosive and ought to have no place in academic or public life. This is a topic which I discuss often with my children and with my husband. And I think standing in this place, in a university, it's a topic that all people who are interested in thoughtful discussion should consider. What is cancel culture? Well, of course, helpfully, there's a substantial debate about that. So I'm going to define what I am going to be speaking about tonight, and I'm sure there's broader definitions that other people would use, but what I'm talking about tonight is public shaming. Public shaming with the intent or the cause or the effect of somehow removing or significantly degrading a person in their position in society. The point of it is to substantially and negatively affect a person's status in the community.
Defamation lawyer Sue Chrysanthou taking on cancel culture. That's in our next episode of Big Ideas. And the show is produced by me, your host Natasha Mitchell, with Claire Slattery, Karin Zivanovits, and our sound engineer David LeMay. and colleagues across Australia. Big thanks to you for your company today. We love hearing from you. You can shoot us a quick email to share what's connecting with you on the show. It is bigideas@abc.net.au. Get in touch. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.